From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour is made with a question. What is your impression of our community, the Greater Rochester community? It's the question that opens the new Hard Facts report from ACT Rochester. And the conclusion is a harsh one. Right out of the gate, the report declares, quote, "We know that our region has many generous and caring people, many effective organizations, resources, and community assets, yet something is profoundly wrong," end quote. This is a report that looks at poverty and educational inequality. Who has opportunity and who does not? It's a report that asks us to see our entire community, not just the neighborhood we live in. Yesterday, ACT Rochester and the Rochester Area Community Foundation released an update to the groundbreaking 2017 Hard Facts Report. In this hour, we welcome the people who compiled the data for this update. Taken together, it's the story of our community, a community of profound inequality. My guests for the hour include Ann Johnson, Executive Director of ACT Rochester, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also on the line, Simeon, it sounds like you're on every day. Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Community Foundation. Welcome back.
Busy, 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 and good to be with you again.
Very busy, of course. That's a compliment. We love having you on the program. And also joining us is Ed Doherty, principal author and researcher of the Hard Facts Update, also the author of the original 2017 Hard Facts Report. Ed, nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Ed, I'd like to start with you. As the author of numerous reports on poverty, you've always been blunt, and you've said that Rochester has more severe problems than most cities of our size. But you've also cautioned that we can't solve these problems in a year or two. So is there anything that indicates to you that our community is now moving in a better direction, looking at the data you've seen with this new report?
Well, it's hard to conclude that just looking at some data points, but certainly there's a lot of good activity, good effort, and goodwill in the community. We have people working on education with Rock the Future. We have the Rochester Anti-Poverty Initiative trying to deal with challenging problems of poverty. And we have a new commission that has just been appointed by the mayor and the county executive to look at issues of race and racial inequality. So I think that it's there's plenty of activity. Now, activity doesn't mean results, and I do advocate for the importance of long-term results. So we conclude this report by identifying some of the really intractable patterns that we've seen in our local community that we think need more attention, ones that are not being addressed by these processes. And so we think that that's going to be critical, and we can talk about those as we move along.
Absolutely. Let's take a look at some of the data. And listeners, the report is available online. We'll link to it on our podcast page once I post the episode for today, so you can click on that link. But Simeon, there's a lot in this report that's frankly disturbing, but here's the part that stood out most to our connections team. In our 9-county region, it's pretty similar to the nation when it comes to demographics, so it would be logical to assume that our outcomes would be pretty close to the national average. But the outcomes here are much worse, the outcomes here in the Greater Rochester region. From your report, here's some of the data. Compared with African Americans in the U.S. as a whole, African Americans in the 9-county Rochester region are more likely to be in poverty, 34% here compared with 24% nationally. Their children are more likely to be in poverty, 49% here versus 35% nationally. African Americans in the Rochester region are more likely to experience unemployment, 13.8% here compared with 10.6% nationally. They have lower incomes, 75 cents on the dollar compared with the nation. They are less likely to own a home, 32% here versus 42% nationally. They pay a higher percent of income for rent, 44% here compared to 35% nationally. And they own homes of a lower value, less than 50% of the nationwide value. It's a lot of data, a lot of numbers, but I think the picture is pretty clear. Simeon, why is it so much worse here?
Well, on your show yesterday, you had some colleagues and friends who were talking a little bit about the history of this community, some of the issues with racial covenants, with redlining, with a lot of historical decisions that were the antecedents to where we are today. What I'd say is that this community has to get a little bit more comfortable with cognitive dissonance. It is entirely true that as the report begins, this is a wonderful community. There are many, many positive attributes. But there is also something else that has gone on here that is a distinction that we need to shed as a community. I also just point out, Megan, that for all of the numbers that you just gave, for all of the statistics that you just offered, that we are talking about real people behind
Absolutely.
Those numbers, right? I'll just, you know, quote quickly from the report that instead of infant mortality, we need to envision the tragedy of an infant death and remember that reality is that three times more likely for African Americans than whites in our region, right? Instead of just the child poverty rate, we need to think about what those kids are enduring and what they're going through. And so, yes, there's a historical set of circumstances that have led us to this point. We've got to unpack that and start making headway for what we can do to move forward.
You mentioned redlining. You mentioned racially restrictive covenants. Those are all issues we can explore either later in this program and additional programs. We had one yesterday, as you mentioned. But I want to thank you for bringing up that human aspect, because there are so many times when in the media statistics are used and reports are analyzed, but we're not talking about the personal impact. When you're sharing this report, and this is a question from all of our guests, when you're sharing this report within the community, with local leaders, how are you representing that human element so it's more relatable to people that, you know, may react in a different way if they see a person affected rather than a number? And how would you approach that question?
So my favorite examples that Ed put together for this report relate to the two areas of disparities that we focused on. One is, how do our people of color in our nine-county community compare to whites? And when he did the, you know, all the different data elements, he rolled it up and said, basically, if people of color had the same poverty rate as our white residents, 50,000 less people would be in poverty in our nine-county region, 50,000 people. That's equivalent to the town of Irondequoit. So that says within our nine-county region, if our people of color did not have inequities in poverty and we were equal, 50,000 people. When we look at the second area that you just talked to Simeon about, if our people of color were at the same poverty level as those nationally, then we would see 21,800 less people in poverty. That is 21,800 people, which is half the population of Webster. Those are a lot, you know, those you can kind of get your arms around as far as the enormity of the opportunity we have to see change.
And do you think using those examples has been effective with the organizations you've worked with as you've shared this data?
The examples Ann just gave, we just published yesterday, so we haven't used those, so to speak.
A tactic, I should say, a tactic like that.
But it is. I mean, I've made dozens and dozens of presentations on these reports around the community over the last 5, 6, 7 years now, I guess it is almost. And people obviously do relate to it when you tell them, you know, this is real people. One of the things I used to start the presentation off with was, who do you, you know, draw a picture in your mind of someone in poverty, and people would stop, and they have all kinds of different views. So the idea is to try to make it very real. One statistic that's in the report that I like to use a lot, and this one hasn't changed, and so I have used it a number of times over the years, is home ownership rates. Everyone knows that Rochester, New York, has relatively affordable housing. It is an asset that we have in the community, and it shows up in the data. 68% of all people in our region live in owned homes. That's higher than the national average of 64%. That makes sense. Home ownership is lower. So why wouldn't there be a higher rate of African Americans living in their own home as compared to the nation? But there's not. There's a lower rate. And same thing with Latinos. So it brings home the idea that even when some aspect of our economy is an asset working for most people, it is not working for African Americans and Latinos. And that's the best we can do, is to try to, you know, put that face on it.
Let me share some of the data regarding disparities involving Latinos in the region, now that you mention it, Ed, so we can explore that as well. Let's see. Latinos here are, compared to the nation, are more likely to be in poverty, 32% compared with 21%. Their children are more likely to be in poverty, 40% versus 28% nationally. They are more likely to experience unemployment, 10.8% here compared with 6.8% nationally. They have lower incomes, 66 cents on the dollar compared with the nation. They're less likely to own a home, as you mentioned, Ed, 35% here versus 47% nationally. They pay a higher percent of income for rent, 44% compared to 32% nationally, and they own homes of a lower value, about 46%. So again, as Simeon said, I want to emphasize these are statistics, but we're talking about real people. And when you're bringing this data to different community organizations, we haven't even touched on education yet, but what are some of the responses people are giving? Again, I know this is new data, but it's an update to what you've done in 2017, Ed. Are leaders surprised by this? Do they express, you know, was it not predictable to them, or?
Sometimes. I find that certainly the public at large, and of course we're invited to talk to people who are sympathetic to hearing the message, and I think that they are often quite surprised. It doesn't fit the image we have of Rochester as being a leader in the country in many ways. Some people do think it's like this somehow happened since Kodak dissolved. You know, it's like this must have just happened. And so whether it's poverty rates or racial ethnic disparities, we do have to make the point that Simeon made earlier, that we have a long culture of creating these realities. And it's resulted in an enormously dramatic concentration of poverty. It's resulted in racial segregation, residential segregation at the racial level that is extraordinary. It has resulted in segregated schools in a fashion that, if it weren't for some technicalities, would be illegal. And it has resulted in other phenomenon. And people don't know how we got there. They keep saying, well, when did this happen? And that's the frustrating part about the data. I've been looking for this sort of magic answer as to why this all happened. And the truth is the things that happened in Rochester were similar to what were going on in most other cities, but more so. We had higher levels of job discrimination. When our manufacturing sector was booming, African Americans simply were not hired into those higher paying jobs. And we are paying a huge cost for that today. When we were developing our suburban communities, zoning and other regulations were working real hard to make sure that African Americans were not welcome in those communities. And we are paying a huge price for that today. So we have to look at ourselves and say, you know, we have to change this. I mean, it's that simple. We have to take the long-term actions necessary to recreate this community if we expect to be a fair and equitable place.
Is it fair to say that one of the gaps is the lack of education surrounding these issues?
I mean, I recently read Richard Rothstein's Color of Law, and there was very little in there that I hadn't heard of, sort of like Through the Grit, but to have it codified in such strong ways, the way in which restrictive covenants were used, the way in which intimidation was used, the way in which all manner of governmental activities were deployed to segregate our country is stunning. And so, yes, we do have to educate ourselves.
I asked that question just thinking about my own experience. I'm from Rochester. I grew up here. I went to a local school district for K through 12. I never learned about any of this. And it's not meant to disparage any teachers I had who were wonderful. And I'm sure the district worked really hard on curriculum. But I had not heard the term redlining until I was in college. And I'm embarrassed to say that. You mentioned The Color of Law, that we've had a conversation on this program about the book, but there's also a great 17-minute video, which you can find on our podcast page from yesterday's program at noon, Right. Which is a great summary of that book, and I learned so much from that. Simeon, you're doing work all around the community on so many different issues, those included. What do you think resonates with people who may not be familiar with some of this history, and do you think understanding that context will create change?
I like to believe so. I like to believe that fundamentally the challenge that we're dealing with is one of ignorance, and that by dispelling that ignorance with the truth, that we're positioning this community to really make, you know, meaningful headway. But I also think one of the, you know, powerful points of this report is showing the ways in which there truly is a common destiny that we have in this community. And so the report tries to, you know, kind of carve out and call out some of the ways in which this community will not be successful if its residents of color continue to suffer in the ways that it has. And we could even extend that further. I'm reminded that the county budget right now, nearly 40% of Monroe County's budget is for human services to redress inequities that should have been covered in the first place. So you've heard me say, I think I've said it on this show before, if you want lower taxes in Monroe County, let's try equity. The next 20% of that budget is for public safety, including county jails and incarceration. If you want to lower tax expenditures, try equity. And so in some ways, what we're, you know, advocating in some through the report, and I want to be clear that this report is not intended to be prescriptive, but to really pose some questions, to ask about the, you know, those underlying inequities. And I think that that kind of resonates with folks to kind of prod some thinking and hopefully to dislodge some old ways of thinking.
Well, I want to talk about some of the action items or thoughts that you have in the seventh section of the report about what we should do going forward. Before we do that, though, we have some listeners waiting to ask their questions. First up on the phone is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, there was some discussion, Megan, about housing and how much less some populations have of that than others, a mortgage, that sort of thing. And I'd like an opinion on just how much the subprime mortgage debacle affected that, because there are big decisions made that do trickle down in a destructive way to various classes and ethnic groups and so on. So it's made at a higher level not to benefit, deliberately, to benefit the higher paid, the 1%, as we say. And also, in addition to that, I agree very much that the people here are very generous and likable people. I've just really enjoyed living here since I moved here. So it doesn't seem to be the person on the street that has these greedy behaviors. But let me see if I can. Oh, yeah. The tax cut of $1.5 trillion. That was promised to go to the middle classes and less than that, to the lower classes, and it did not. It went to the wealthiest people in the country. All those types of things add up to the disfavor of people who are poor because they don't get their fair share. We don't get our fair share. But first, things like the subprime mortgage, I kind of like a reaction to that, these sort of high-level decisions made to benefit just maybe 1% of us. Thank you very much, Megan.
Thank you, Jane. Jane mentioning some of the compounding factors that play into this. Simeon, do you want to respond to some of Jane's comments?
Yeah, specifically the question about the subprime crisis. So one of the interesting dynamics in Rochester is that folks in that we've had a relatively stable housing market since like time immemorial, right? But one of the fascinating dynamics is that coming out of the 2008 crisis where housing prices around the country collapsed, in Rochester, the relatively steady housing market made us a very attractive place for income protection. And so a lot of people bought into our market to be able to preserve some of their capital. In so doing, what we see now is that we've got the hottest real estate market in the country. Lots of investors had bought in here, reducing the supply and increasing the prices. Well, what's the knock-on effect? As is often the case, the people that are paying the price In this case, are folks that are living in the city of Rochester who don't have means, who are on the downside of skyrocketing rents because the market can command a higher price. And so folks are then displaced, and we are all waiting with bated breath for the economic cataclysm that awaits us. And the New York Times pointed this out just a couple of days ago as a result of COVID-19, particularly as some of the protections for evictions are lifted. And I think that's kind of the point here, is that it's these underlying structures. Justin Murphy today in the Democrat and Chronicle has an article where he describes the impact that the cuts that are going to be coming from the state level. It's going to be a more profound cut for the city of Rochester than for many of our suburban towns, because the share of dollars that come to the city are much greater coming from state aid, because we don't levy our own property taxes. And that's a different structural system for what happens out in our suburban towns, where a 20% cut in real terms ends up being something like 5%. In the city, it's actually amplified to 21%. And so why all that matters is that we see the same pattern over and over and over again. But as the report points out, in many instances, these policies and decisions today are racially benign. Hey, listen, it's just a 20% cut across the board, right? We're not picking winners. It's just a 20% state cut across the board. But we know that because of these historical decisions, because of the inequities, then we see the same pattern continue to play out of adverse outcomes for people of color. And that's what we've got to focus on, right? We've got to focus on the adverse outcomes and not only get caught up in the in the decisions as they are written on paper today. The other thing I'll just say is that the other piece that we've got to make the connection between is how individual bias then affects some of the decision-making. So it's not an either-or proposition. Jane kind of referenced, you know, good folks, nice folks. You can be a good person and a nice person and at the same time participate in a system that is fundamentally flawed in this way. And the fact is that all of us are hurt by that system, and that's the real irony.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to that issue, intent, you know, you're a good person, you're a nice person, as Simeon said, but you're not actively working toward creating a solution that is anti-racist, not just non-racist, but anti-racist. What does that mean for communities like ours?
So in our community, as Ed mentioned, we have lots of organizations and initiatives and collaboratives with good intent doing lots of activity. I believe that as we go forward, in order to really make the change that people are asking for because of what's happening, not only with the visibility on race and ethnicity right now, but also with COVID, is that we need to start to think outside the box in our solution development. And we can't have silos within these different collaboratives drive what solutions are developed. So for me, in order for us to move the needle on some of the things that are happening that Simeon said, and that, you know, we're not thinking about this in a way that's really negative, but more we're good people, is that we have to have a mutual purpose. So when I look at the new commission, you know, we want to work toward our common good. Well, what is that? I want to know specifically what good we're moving. I want the 21 people at the table to leave their hats outside the door and come in and work toward whatever the common good is that is clearly defined. And I want each one of them, even if they have to take a hit, let's say everybody takes a 10% hit on either the money they get or the number of resources they have or whatever, I want them to come to the table for the better good. If there are policy changes, I want them to understand the unintended consequences. So if you're sitting at the table and that policy is really good for you, there are enough diverse people at that table to bring up where it might cause a problem. And I believe as a community, because we've done lots of activity and we've tried many different solutions, we haven't first started with the what exactly do we want to see change and how do we get everyone in this community that is working toward change to align to that same mutual purpose. And then not only when you have mutual purpose, you have to have mutual respect. You got to listen to the person with the outlandish idea, because while it might be outlandish, working together as a team, you might be able to do something that's really unique but not quite as outlandish that moves the needle. I really think that's where we are, and same old is going to have us here 3 years from now looking at data that hasn't moved.
How optimistic are you, Anne, that people in the community, I want to go back to what you said about taking a cut, whether it's a 10% cut in a certain area, how optimistic do you think the general community would be? Would they do that?
So the good news is, as Simeon just said, with 50% of the money coming into Rochester being from the state government, we know we're going to be in trouble. So it's not like, what if I kind of hide, I can still keep my amount. I think most everybody's going to be in a challenging situation. So let's use this opportunity to say, how do we minimize the impact by banding together, knowing we're all probably going to take a hit, but maximizing it in a way that we can move forward. You know, personalities are unique. I've run a lot of teams in my career that we've had to do these things, but they've been within one organization, State of West Virginia, or when I was with Xerox. It's hard to do it when you're asking people who sit in different places to come together for a community where there's no direct accountability. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the time, and that's why, you know, this report wasn't on our work plan this year to update it. But because of what we saw happening in the first quarter, we decided to update it. The data is updated from the last report. So when you asked, Ed, was it a surprise? It's a surprise to some people, but not everybody. But we did it because we wanted to highlight these what-if questions and the Section 7 about how do we really start to think outside the box without being prescriptive, mm-hmm. but just really pushing people to go to that next level. So am I optimistic? Well, I feel like we've done our part to push this, and I'm hoping people will listen and be different in the way they approach things.
Up next on the phones is Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I took a quick look at this report, and there's one thing that really jumps out as far as correlation between poverty rates, and that's the rate of single-family households. If you look at the city of Rochester, for the period for 2018, it's up to 74% are headed by a single parent, and that's an increase of 4 percentage points from 2009 to 13 and 12 percentage points from 2000. So in 2000, that number was only 62%. And I'm just curious what efforts these organizations have taken to reduce the single-parent household rate.
All right. Thanks, Robert. I'm going to turn that over to Simeon or Ed.
Well, I'll start. This is Ed. It's a tough question, and it's true. It's a fact. Single-parent-headed households make up a tremendous portion of the poverty rate. When you look at poverty rate, and I'm going to say this over and over and over again, you look at the poverty rate in Monroe County or the Rochester region, we are not a high poverty region. We have average levels of poverty. It is the extraordinary concentration of that poverty within one jurisdiction that creates the debilitating realities that we have. And that has to do with a lot of things. For example, very, very little rental housing available outside the city. Almost no affordable rental housing available outside the city. So while I understand the importance of long-term changes in the way in which the world operates, the truth of the matter is we're not different than any other place. We're just concentrating our poverty into a smaller area, and therefore not only creating secondary effects of poverty, but creating a tax base that can't support that. It's very, very debilitating. The city of Rochester, through the RMAPI process, did a rather significant analysis recently on the impacts of poverty on single parent households, and nobody is hiding this fact. The solutions are not clear. They're not solutions that are available to one jurisdiction versus another. But we do have to stop this practice of saying, well, all right. I mean, I'll give you another example. People with disabilities account for 25% of the city's poverty, a huge percentage. People with disabilities in our community who are poor, 68% of those people in the entire county live within the city of Rochester. So again, we're concentrating high need populations into a small geographic area and a geographic area without the economic capacity to deal with it. We gotta actually change some things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the comment that came to my mind as I was thinking about, you know, the changes in the national economic realities. When things get better, when the economy improves, we all take a sort of sigh of relief and say, okay, things are better. But every time there's a downturn, whether it be a natural business cycle downturn or something like the COVID downturn or something extraordinary like the 2008 housing bubble, it exposes how the system doesn't work for certain people in a way that's instructive for us.
Mm-hmm.
If we could, in the processes of remedying that, we would deal with these ups and downs in a much more palatable way as a community.
Simeon, do you want to weigh in on that issue as well?
Sure, yeah. And if this is the same Robert that I recall from the time that I visited with you guys before, Robert, I'm still waiting for you to give me a call.
Yeah.
and still invite you to do so. But at any rate, look, I think what Robert's dealing with is what I like to call a lens problem. What Ed has done in this report is invited us to use the right lens. When I was a kid, I remember sitting in bio class and using the microscope to look at fruit flies. I couldn't use that microscope to scan the room, right? It was more for detail. I think many of the approaches that we take, we use the microscope, which shows us symptoms and not the bigger picture. And so if we think about the question that Robert's asking about single families, what causes that? What's the root cause, right? When we start to track it back and we think about the instability of economic opportunity, when we think about all the data that's in this report that shows us that the conditions are such that being able to build and maintain what some might call, quote unquote, traditional families is nearly impossible because it's hard to find a job. And the reason why it's hard to find a job is because, as the report notes, many of the businesses have moved out to exurbs and suburbs. And so the economic opportunity isn't there. When you don't have economic opportunity and you got to figure out how to survive, maybe you do some things that get you criminal justice involved. Maybe that makes you somebody that isn't as attractive as marriage material and ultimately leads to a scenario where you have families that have to improvise to get by. At the end of the day, we have to get to the root cause, and the root causes are systemic and structural. And so that's not about the individual as much as it is about how we look at the set of circumstances that created it. And just for Robert's benefit, if you don't call me, definitely go back and reread the report and look at point two under the section that suggests that we look at community-wide collective action. And in that section, we try to say it pretty clearly. Poverty, especially racially poverty in this region, has to be viewed through this lens to fully appreciate why it is so stubborn to engage. We give an example of a young person living in the Crescent, all the challenges that they confront. We have to think about community-wide deprivation, the implications that it has for any individual child that's living in our living in the sections of our community that have been so deprived. If we are willing to do that, then we can see how the structures that are in place are causing this, and not just individuals' moral defects, which is frankly patently ridiculous and a racist idea.
All right, we're going to take our only break of the hour, and when we come back, some emails from our listeners, more about this report itself, and then some conversation about what we can do to improve outcomes moving forward. So stay with us. We'll have more Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Monday on The Next Connections, on the 100-year anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, President Trump pardoned Susan B. Anthony for voting before it was legal for women to do so. But the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum says they're rejecting that pardon on behalf of Anthony, who wouldn't want it. We discuss that and the state of voting and equal rights in America. Talk to you Monday. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the Hard Facts Update Report. It's about racial and ethnic disparities in the greater Rochester community, the nine-county region. Some difficult data to look at from the report's authors, from ACT Rochester, the Rochester Area Community Foundation. They're on the line with us today. Ann Johnson is the executive director of ACT Rochester. Simeon Bannister is the vice president of community programs at the Rochester Community Foundation. And Ed Doherty is the principal author and researcher of the report, The Hard Facts Update. I want to get to some of the listener questions that are coming in, both over email and on social media. And one is directed about a comment I had made earlier about not learning about redlining. And a listener who didn't leave their name says, "You complained that you never learned in grade school and high school about redlining. The purpose of school is to teach you to read, write, and do math. You take those skills and pursue knowledge. Instead of always trying to place blame on others, take responsibility." So I just want to be clear. I am not blaming the educational system for not putting that curriculum into my educational experience. I didn't mean to disparage any teachers. And it is my responsibility to pursue things that I didn't learn, which I'm trying to do now. Of course, I can always do better. And I don't want to disparage teachers in general. They're working under very difficult circumstances right now and always have. So to this listener, I certainly take responsibility for myself, and I think we all have individual responsibility when it comes to learning things. But going back to what Simeon said about lenses, some of us grow up with white privilege and are not exposed to some of these issues until later in life. And I regret that. And I'm trying to correct that in my own life. And I'm sure some listeners have different experiences, different feelings about that. But my hope is that we all, including myself, can do better. So here's a question from a listener named Don, who says, "Who has handled some of these kind of problems well, those that are mentioned in the report, and who can we look to for an example? Ed, are there any communities that you think have handled these problems in ways that have improved their communities?"
I think there are. They are communities, unfortunately, who dealt with these issues 25, 35 years ago. You know, we all have heard about what Raleigh, North Carolina did when they set a goal back in the 1970s that no school would have more than 40% poverty. And then they realized that the way to do that was to create a countywide school system, and they've been able to maintain that. And by the way, there's a community that's excelled as a community. Or we can look at a place like Indianapolis, where they realized that they needed to have broader government structures in order to be able to create the kinds of development changes that were needed. And there's a community that has thrived. Or we could look at a community like Nashville and Davidson County, where they made determinations early on that their overall development patterns, they were going to be a rapidly growing community, and they didn't want to create the kinds of concentrations of poverty that existed in other places. And so they created metropolitan-wide systems. And there's a community that is thriving. So if you look at virtually any community that made smart decisions in the 70s and 80s to actually make changes in the way their governments are structured, they haven't solved all their problems, but they have thrived. And that's the key here. We're talking about needing a combination of both national policy change and local actions. And we're trying, in a sense, to keep the focus on local actions, despite the fact that there's very, very little will to do anything on a nationwide basis. And that makes it doubly challenging. But there are things that we can do to begin to change the way in which our community has developed. And the communities that have done it have had successes.
So let's talk about... Oh, go ahead.
And just one more point. This is affecting us as a whole region. The report has a section titled, "Does This Matter?" that looks at just a couple of factors and talks about how our inability to relate to those, to meet those challenges, is holding back the entire region. For the first time ever, our educational outcomes as an entire region are lower than the New York State average. That's critical. That is a critical reality, and the data is pretty clear that this is happening precipitously, and it's not just the result of our inability to have a better way of helping people of color to be able to academically thrive. But that's a big part of it, and so it's important that we face this. Otherwise, we're going to really continue to move into the backwaters.
Megan, really, really quickly, I just want to
sure.
connect the last two questions because I think that there's an interesting connection. Mecklenburg County, where Charlotte, North Carolina is located, had a consent decree to integrate education back in the 70s in a similar way that that Ed just described. My had a personal mentor, a guy named Julius Chambers, who argued that case and got the consent decree put into place. For years, they enjoyed some of the most integrated schools in the nation. That consent decree was lifted, and almost reflexively, the same segregatory patterns that had existed pre the consent decree began to snap back into place. And I make that connection because you very modestly took responsibility, and that's absolutely appreciated. But it's also the case that the systems that are in place are the waters that we all swim in, right? And so unless we're able to start to change the culture, to change the baseline assumptions that we all have about what's right and what's wrong, what works and what doesn't work, then even when we have legislated or decisions that are put in place through the courts, we will still flex back to similarly the same patterns if the culture doesn't change. And the way we change culture is education. Because education isn't just about reading and writing and arithmetic. Education is also about socialization and about how we establish shared values through society. It's actually one of the most important, perhaps the most important element of education. And so the stories that get told, what gets read, the historic figures that are lifted up, that all matters too. And that's why I think your guest yesterday, we're talking about how to change the curriculum so that every kid has a better, more accurate shared understanding, not just about teaching, you know, African-American history, by the way, but just an accurate understanding of history. And that's the way that we start to make the kinds of changes that last even after legislative decisions change.
I think that's a great point. Absolutely, Simeon.
Agreed.
We're down to our last 10-ish minutes of the program, and I want to make sure we talk about some tangible action items for our community moving forward. But before I do that, Ed, I want to ask you, I want to rely on your usual bluntness with this question, and that's a compliment. I'd like to give you an opportunity to offer your thoughts about whether you think our community's leadership is serious enough about this issue and informed enough about it to make changes when it comes to the data that you're showing them in, or will be showing them in the reports.
I think so. I view the kind of fundamental change that we're talking about as taking time, requiring first awareness, followed by understanding, followed by action. And unfortunately, we're still in that awareness phase. But I think the awareness has been improved considerably in recent years. We're struggling with understanding exactly why all this happened. But I think if we work our way through that, then I think that the kind of people that we have in this community have both the integrity and the intelligence to find better ways. So I do believe that we have the potential to do it.
So let's go through some action items, and these are not just individual actions. We've talked a lot in the last few days about how systemic change is necessary. You know, you can call your lawyer and ask to change the racist property deed that might be on your household from decades ago, but really the change is Connor Dwyer Reynolds, who told us yesterday, where that change comes is systemically. So, Simeon, you've mentioned a lot about residency requirements or commuter taxes is something that should be explored. If you could share for our listeners, if they may have missed that last conversation that you discussed all those issues on the program, if you could summarize that in a way, that would be excellent.
Yeah, the basic upshot is that the underlying economic reality in our community, what the bedrock that all of these statistics and disparities lives on, is that we have an extractive economy that draws a lot of resources out of the city and into the suburban towns. And again, Justin Murphy's article today is emblematic of that. And so the question is, how do we create the right, the mechanism to bring the resources that are necessary to actually try to solve some of the challenges that we have? Now, there are some people that are listening that might say, yeah, but we spend tons and tons on charity and nonprofits. There certainly is, we're a wonderfully benevolent community. There's a lot of of philanthropic activity. I'm grateful for this community's impulse towards philanthropy. But we also have to recognize that the scale of the challenges and, again, the historic nature of those challenges require us to mobilize more resources. And so a commuter tax, as an example, could be one way of raising, 4% commuter tax by some calculations could raise an additional $120 million that could be used explicitly to remedy some of the issues around the historically racialized harm that has been done to communities of color. Residency requirements are another. There's a great report out of the Institute for Poverty Research at University of Wisconsin-Madison a long time ago, 1981, that basically shows that residency requirements can help mobilize dollars, and not only mobilize dollars, but also create more job opportunities for urban dwellers in the municipal sector. So those are things that we got to explore. I mean, you know, they're not prescribing them. Again, that's not the purpose of this report. Is not to prescribe a solution, but to say that there are things that we can do, and we need to at least start to dig into them and to find out and to do the homework to determine whether they might be the solutions for our community.
When it comes to education, Ann, we talked a bit about countywide schools. What else do you think we should be exploring in that realm?
So I'd like to give an example that I think ties a lot of what we've talked about today together. And it's an example of a very proactive school teacher who teaches fourth grade in Rush Henrietta. And at the end of the school year, he teaches redlining. And so after the first ACT Rochester report came out, he invited me to meet with his fourth graders. And probably the most disappointing thing for me, and there have been many since COVID has hit, was not to be able to meet for the third year in a row with Shane Wygand's fourth graders. Shane goes through the hard facts report and works with his students, fourth graders, to meet with me and ask questions, most of which I can't answer because they include questions like, were white people happy when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed? Or can black couples adopt white babies? But they're profound and curious questions that could lead to amazing discussions. So on an individual basis, that's what Shane has done. But he has gotten approval after working with the community and getting some funding to formalize this fourth grade curriculum that he's built for all of Rush Henrietta schools and to offer them to other schools who are interested. He has also now gotten a group together to put together an eighth grade curriculum. And he's gotten interest in, at such a wide level that this group plans at some point to go to New York State and ask for this curriculum to be put in statewide. So I'm looking at someone who's individual, making an impact, and looking at some systemic change and doing the work and gathering the people around him to help him support getting this done. I can't tell you, I would never have thought that this kind of discussion at a fourth grade level would make sense. And yet these kids are our future. You know, I love the quote, children are living messages we send to a time we will not see. And I think individuals taking this kind of action can make a difference. And at the same time, for people empowered to support that this be done in a broader way, just this step with some curriculum change can be enormous.
Thank you for that, Anne. You're absolutely right. And I think my comment about individual action may have been a little too narrow before, because as you said, Shane's individual action has created systemic change. So I think these issues are complicated, and I'm glad that you are all here with us to help us understand them better. We're down to our last couple minutes, and Ed, I'd like to send the last question your way, and it comes from Rich in Rochester, who we don't have time to take his phone call, but he wants to reiterate all of the things that young people have to deal with. He says the report is showing some of these struggles, poverty, educational disparities. When you're looking at this data and you're keeping all of that in mind, again, these are people we're talking about, not just statistics. What is the message you want to share with the public when you consider all of those compounding effects?
Well, you know, I guess I'd like to leave with a sort of an optimistic idea, not optimistic about what we are, but optimistic about what we could create. For some reason, we fear a better community. And that's the thing that I think we need to overcome. You know, people will look at this report and say, oh, this is about sending money to the city, or this is about this. It's not. It's about creating an equitable community. And having an equitable community is certainly not a bad thing, and it's not something to fear. So we're not talking about people having to sacrifice things. You know, I have a 32-year-old daughter who deals with these issues and talks about the struggles of young people today, and I get that. It's a different world than the one I grew up with. But we as a community have to think about what kind of long-term community we're building for everybody, and I think that we can help do that. Change is not something to fear. Change is something that will help us and set us free.
I'd like to thank all of our guests today for helping us understand the data in this report, and more importantly, its impacts, especially when we look at the context of our situation here in the Rochester region, where we've come from, and what we can do in the future. So Ann Johnson, Executive Director of ACT Rochester, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks,
everybody.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Ed Doherty, the principal author of the report, and Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Thank you all
very much, Megan.
We appreciate your work. And listeners, you can find that report on our podcast page in probably about an hour once I am able to post it up there. But thank you for listening. Our thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer, to Ra Ra Riot and Barsook Records for our theme music, of course. I'm Megan Mack sitting in for Evan Dawson today. He will be back on Monday. In the meantime, have a great weekend, everyone, and thank you for supporting Public Radio.